accession number 9422, reel 16.
Mr. Harold Hayward, reel 16. You were telling me about what happened when you arrived in England after you'd received your second wound in August.
Dover. We came up through there. We wondered which hospital we should land at. I was hoping it was not too far away from my parents' home in Bristol. Eventually, it was Birmingham, and it was one of the larger sites of Birmingham University, which had been converted into an army hospital. And of course there was full RAMC, both nurses and medical officers there. And even then I'd had some pretty uncomfortable days, and more than that, nights through this double dose, you know, which the Americans wanted to try their apprentice hand on, and this thing was going around my body, which was already surfeited, you know, with the two proper ones, and I had it everywhere, every blessed place, in my eyelids, in my privates, on hands and arms. It travelled round the body, which, as though it was trying to find a place where something would absorb it, but it was that was already dealt with by the British. And
what happened? What were the symptoms?
Stinging. Yeah, stinging. That's the best word I should say. Stinging. My parents came up from Bristol to see me. That was pleasant, but I tried to hide what I was then going through, because it was with me all the time, and it seemed that night time in particular I hardly got any sleep. And then the young RAMC officer in charge of the ward I was said, well, we'll have to give you another dose. I said, I've had one dose. He said, you can't have had a second dose after the first one which you had, you know, just coming out of the line. I said, I did. It was the Americans insisted on doing it. He said, we're going to give you the one which is normally due a fortnight after the first one. I said, I won't have it. I said, no, I shan't. I said, I've had enough of this stinging. And he brought a colleague, and I said no to him. And then in an hour, the senior medical officer came up and said, I understand you're refusing orders. I said, well, I told him what I'm now telling you. He said, unless you have another one, he said, there'll be a court-martial. I said, I'll have a court-martial. It so happened that the sister in charge of the group of wards, in one of which I was, she knew all about it, but it happened she was on 3 days' leave, so I had to wait for 3 days till she should come back, who could speak to the SMO. And then when she told him what I'd been through, had to have gloves on at night, and I was in poor shape and at the mercy of this American dose, so close up to the other one, the first one, that life wasn't too pleasant, hadn't been too pleasant for 3 days. She knew all about that because the sister in charge of that ward had brought her in to see what it was. So she had my case, you know, at once, and she stood up to the SMO. No more.
It sounds as if this double tetanus injection caused you more problems than your wound.
Oh, yes! It certainly did. Yes, it certainly did.
How long were you in hospital in Birmingham?
About a month. little less, perhaps. It wasn't a serious thing, and I don't think I was x-rayed.
Did you go back to your regiment at any time after?
Well, I regarded my regiment, the first unit I belonged to, Bristol's Own, as much, probably more so, than the Welsh Regiment.
Did you go back to the Welsh Regiment, though, at all?
No, no. But I was very pleased when the an appeal came from the man running starting a fund for the Welsh Division, 38th Welsh Division, sent to our battalion of the WFA an appeal that I should be able to give something towards the memorial that they were going to put up at Mamet's Wood, where they lost a lot of men. That was before I joined them.
So when were you discharged from the army?
As quick as I could get out when I knew I had to be, because of this explosion. Not so bad as in the First World War, but still an explosion of men. And I had a friend who worked for a firm which had its headquarters, the British American Tobacco Company, moved to London. And when I went down as a civilian after the medical board discharged.
And when was that? When were you discharged? Was that January 1990?
January, February. I just can't remember, something like that. There was an office at Bristol under the Ministry of Labour which dealt with people passing from military to back into Civvy Street. And I was offered a job. I was offered a job at the zoo, oddly enough. And I didn't mind what it was, as long as it was a job. That, in other words, I'd got a slot to sit in with a large number of people coming out. But before I went up to the Zoological Gardens, and I should have got that job. I didn't think it had much prospect, but I thought it would be interesting. But before I could actually take it up, I heard from a bank through this particular unit dealing with vacancies, and I thought, well, with this wound in my back, I don't know, but I thought, well, it's really give more advantage for promotion or than at the Bristol branch, Bristol Zoo, which would be one job only. Interesting though that would have been, and so I decided to take this job in Holt's Bank, a private bank, not one of the joint stock, and I got taken on, and I found myself amongst about 150 other discharged officers doing the same ordinary clerical work, but still you were being paid week by week. My friend with whom one of the reasons why I aren't I was attracted to it, but one of the reasons which enabled me to take it up without any more searching around was this friend of mine who'd been in Bristol's Own, and his photograph, I think I've shown you him going over the top. His farm had been moved from Bristol to London during the war, and he'd been, when he came out of the forces, joined them at their big offices opposite the House of Lords, and I said, well, now, is there any chance of me getting digs? He said, well, I'll ask my landlady, and with a bit of push-up, I got in with him. That really made all the difference. I'd got a job, and I'd got accommodation, and I went to London and joined Holt's Bank. But my friend, who had to get in at 9:15, so we had digs in Wandsworth, I think, and I travelled with him naturally every morning, and at about 5:20 to 9, he coming round the Abbey, he turned right, and I turned left to come up Whitehall, at the top of which a Holt's Bank was, and this meant that I got in every morning, you know, at a very good prompt 10 or 5 minutes to 9. The upshot of it was that, well, as I say, there was about 100 or more people comparable to myself, but all temporary, and till about where are we now? I should think that this would be March 1919. I was sent for by the staff manager, and he said that do you want a permanent job? I said, yes, I do, please. I should be very pleased to have a permanent job here. I've got to know the people, I've got to know the work. I hadn't thought, I said, of it being a permanency. He said, well, he said, we are now thinking of recruiting our post-war, because that Holt's Bank dealt with the RAF in the same capacity as what was the firm that dealt with army subalterns' pay? I'll think of it in a minute. I ought to have thought of it before. I mean, I heard people say, I've just had a letter from the bank to say that I've got no money. He said, I've got half a dozen checks, forms. You know, people had never done a thing before the war. They thought they were cushy, having check forms. Anyway, I was offered and took a permanent job in Holt's private bank. I know, they call them the agent. They were agents from the RAF headquarters to their commissioned staff. And so I thought, well, at least I'm sitting reasonably pretty, because this was at the top of Whitehall where their head office was, or family office. I walked across the Parliament Square, and it impressed me when I saw ex-RAF officers with bars of medals up, blindfold, boxer matches, sir, boxer matches. I thought, well, thank goodness I said yes to the staff manager, otherwise I might have found myself doing just the same.
How did the First World War affect you mentally and physically, positively and negatively, do you think?
I can't say that it made me a pacifist. Well, it was a less glamorous attitude to war than I'd previously had in my mind, being interested in history and all that meant, you know, Wellington and Marlborough.
Did you feel it had achieved what it had set out to do then?
It was probably influenced by the fact that I joined Bristol's own Old Comrades Association, because being a unit raised within a town, it was simple for them to start up an OCA, which they did in November 1918. You know, as soon as the war was over, this group started up, and I was one of the early members of it, and pleased to be along with friends, you know, whom I'd been out in action with, that we had a bond, and a particular friend of mine who had been at school with me was the accountant for it. So I was well tied up with the OCA, and though I didn't go to France on tours with them, you know, people go. Because I also joined TOC H, which came out of the war. Have you heard of TOC H, Tubby Clayton? And I had been out once or twice with them, both taking in the battlefields, because Tubby's they had had a place, a house, a poppering. Is that right? Yeah, sir. Behind the salient. And so I've been back several occasions, not only just to go round, not only just to say what was called at the old house, and to have the atmosphere of the fellows like myself who'd been in the war, there, in at this very comfortable place, where the local citizens are popping, made a bit of a fuss of us, you know, but also being taken with them round the, first of all, the battlefields, the strong points, in the salient, though I never served there, but I did get back down once or twice to a larger excursion, taking in an owlbear and places like that, which of course was known ground to me. But it was then that it occurred to me for the first time that it was wrongly named the Somme. The Somme was two French armies away from it. We didn't go farther than Albert to the right. That was the right of Haig's command. And there were two French armies on our right flank before we reached the Somme. It really should have been called the Ancre, which was a tributary, as I say, flowing from the northeast into the Somme.
Did you have any lasting physical effects from your back wounds? Or?
Well, some. Well, I passed. I sat for. I had a job offered to me. After. Oh, I know. You've just cut in. Holtz Bank said, well, if you come on our permanent staff, you'll have to do with what is our usual practice, you know, have an insurance. So I went, so they, that was arranged for me to get they put me in touch with their insurance company. When I went there, I found it wasn't, as I supposed, just the agent with whom they dealt, but it was the doctor. Apparently the insurance company had said okay, but of course procedure is for a doctor to examine you, because an insurance is taken out, you see, and they don't want to take you there on a poor life. And the doctor said to me, he said, well, if I were you, old man, he said, I don't think I should go in, keep in a bank. He said, with your wound, that was this one here, you know, in the back. I said, well, I said you must know the state of the employment position to people like myself. And I kept on, but then went back. But my home was in Bristol, and there was just the. I had a long holiday, that's right. I said, I thought to myself, before I take up this permanently job, I ought to have a good holiday, and went with my mother down to Burnham-on-Sea and had a very good time there. And although I couldn't go out swimming as mother did, at least I went into the water. Without a doubt, that holiday did me a lot of good. And when I came back, I went to this Ministry of Labour office again, and they said, well, we've got a job come in. It's we've got one man in Bristol, one man in Gloucestershire, one man in Somerset, and one man in Wiltshire. The Wiltshire job hasn't been taken up. He said, would you like it? I said, well, what does it involve? He said, it means going round the whole of Wiltshire at that time, though, it was the law that no one could start up a business without government consent granted through the Ministry of Labour. And so the Ministry of Labour had a man in each county or in large town like Cardiff or Bristol, and they sent out to make inquiries in this town whether there was someone who had a business which had to be closed down because he had been called up for the forces, and if somebody had started up whilst he was still in the forces, he might not get his business back. So that was a job after my own heart, as you can well imagine, to looking after a fellow who'd been in the forces. And I did that on a bicycle all round Wiltshire. It was pretty stiff going, I remember, with the wind blowing from the southwest over the hills where they train horses. You know, they train horses, and now the wind blowing straight at me, and rain, and I had a cape. There was I trying to pedal against this rainstorm. Nonetheless, I was paddling home every time. Although it was a good distance, I used to ride home on my bike, though I set out just to Templemead Station on my bike, and then took a train to, I forgot now, the capital of Wiltshire. But coming home, I arranged my calls so that the last one would be pointing towards Bristol. I might have only had perhaps 20 miles to ride, but it was a strenuous game with a big cape up like that anyway, and I carried on with that, and quite a menial sort of a job, till I heard that the Ministry of Labour were going to have an exam for temporary employees, for people to go on their permanent staff. I sat and I passed on what was waiting for the result. I heard of the Customs and Excise Government Department were also getting people in then on by exam. So although I'd sat the Ministry of Labour exam, I went and saw the registrar of the new region they were opening at Bristol with a view to getting into a rather more important. Ministry of Labour was only just raised in the war. Customs and Excise, I knew, was back in Cromwell's time. And I saw the registrar, and I told him what I said. I hear you're employing temporary staff for your department. Now you're opening it region-wise. And I said, I would like to come into the Customs and Excise. He said, well, as a matter of fact, he said, I am a Customs and Excise officer whom they've got to act as registrar for this western region. And so he took a sort of particular interest in that it was back into his department. I wished to get a permanency. He said, well, you go downstairs and the registrar down there in the registry will tell you what to do. She still is. She still is.
Oh, that became your wife.
Yeah. And then I sat this examination of the Customs and Excise, and with that ran an interview. Well, I knew my shortcomings in with my pen in my hand sitting exams, but I didn't know how I should show up by an interview. Anyway, I went to this interview, and they said, oh, it's every quarter of an hour. Everybody gets a quarter of an hour to say, you know, what he can for himself. And I went in, and it gave me a little time to think of what my approach should be. One was a undersecretary of the department, you know, quite a high civil service rank, as you would know. And with two men one side of him, two another, and someone just away up there that I could just say. So I went in and tried to be as polite as I could as I went in. I included the other members. I said, good morning, sir, and good morning, gentlemen. I thought I couldn't do any harm. And I saw this chap on the end write something down. I thought, blimey, if he written ordinary stuff, natural stuff like this, what isn't he going to write down? So I thought, I've got to be jolly careful in my replies. I know, he said to me, he was asking me, I said, well, yes, I play rugby for the old boys of the school. And he said, well, you don't do much reading then. I said, well, I'm not a bookworm. Actually, I was reading the particular novel which had come out, the name of which I forget, which would have damned me at once if I'd said that was my style of reading. I said, well, on occasion I'd go down to the public library and see what the different editors say, you know, on any particular important subject which has cropped up in Parliament. he said, "Oh yes, which papers?" I always said, "I read the Observer for one." As I said, he said, "Who's the editor?" And I'd already been ready, perhaps, for that one. So, but I didn't know whether the editor might have been his brother-in-law, and that he liked very much or disliked very much. So I thought I'd better be careful. I said, "Well," I said, "it's the name's, I came in to tell you, Mr. so-and-so." He said, "Well, what do you think of so-and-so?" I said, "Well, I think he's very broad, sir." He said, "Yes, not only is he broad, but he's very long. And all the people on the side of him," he smiled and the others laughed. So I laughed with him. I thought, this is the place to show some agreement. And then he asked me different questions of that nature. And eventually, when I got out, the fellow said, "Who? They can't make much of you. You've been in for 25 minutes." And actually, I thought that was all to my detriment, but it proved to be to my advantage. They were a bit interested in me, and everything I said, this chap on the far end of the line was writing down. Anyway, got me the job in the custom excise, and in Bristol, because, as you know, Bristol had two great advantages in that department: Wills's tobacco, and of course the imports, and as well as the ordinary town work. So I spent at least a year there, learning all the different bits and pieces within that very varied department. I thought that I had a bit of information on everything that was available, but eventually the senior officer there, the collector on commandeer of the said for me one day, he said, "So I'm afraid, Mr. Hayward, I've got to move you." And I said, "Oh, how is this?" I said, "I like being in Bristol. I'm living at home, which is a great thing." And there was no payment, no extra payment by the department for digs for me to be in. And he said, "Well," he said, "you're the junior. Others junior to you have gone, and now you're the bottom of the list. Someone's got to go to Gloucester, and it must be you." I said, "Well," I said, "I'm sorry about this." This was a year after I was there, and I'd been still keep, and Olive was still there, in the Ministry of Pensions, and our relationship was developing. But I had to go, and he said, "Well," he said, "I can tell you, you've had an advocate far from yourself." He said, "Because you play for the tennis for the Customs Excise Club." I said, "Yes." And he said, "You know that there's a tournament on." I said, "Yes." He said, "You knew, of course, that my daughter was your partner." I said, "Yes." He said, "And she's begged hard for you to stay." So it didn't matter, I had to go. And that's where I went to Gloucester. It wasn't the headquarters of a collection, but a town inner collection where a match factory had started up. Did you remember Brighton Maize? No, you don't know. Well, a rival to that had started up, and they wanted staff, and they wanted Bristol to supply at least one member to staff this match factory, because we were duty on matches. That